We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and FM 90.9 HD2, online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. When we shop for food and prepare our meals, we may think about taste, cost, convenience, and nutritional value. We may also consider where and how our food was grown and processed and its environmental impact. But how much do we know, really, about how to eat ethically? There's a lot of information out there, and a lot of it is confusing and or contradictory. Our guest this afternoon is historian James McWilliams. He says, for example, buying locally grown foods from small farms is not always the ethical way to eat. There are, he says, limits to the locavore vision. He also says genetically modified crops don't deserve to be roundly condemned. They have their place. And he says we shouldn't be eating so much meat. It should be treated as what he calls the new caviar. McWilliams sets out his arguments for these positions and others in his new book, Just Food, Where Locavores Get It Wrong and How We Can Truly Eat Responsibly. Listeners, what comments and questions do you have for our guest, James McWilliams? Join us this afternoon with a phone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Toll free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Let me tell you a bit more about our guest. James McWilliams is an associate professor of history at Texas State University, San Marcos, and a recent fellow in the Agrarian Studies program at Yale. His writings have appeared in a number of publications, including the New York Times, Washington Post, Los Angeles Times, and Slate. His three previous books include A Revolution in Eating, How the Quest for Food Shaped America. His new book, Just Food, Where Locavores Get It Wrong and How We Can Truly Eat Responsibly, is published by Little Brown. More about our guest and his book online at the website www.justfoodforpeople.wordpress.com. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. James McWilliams, good afternoon. Thank you.
Hello. Thanks for having me on.
Sure. Well, you were once a full-throttle locavore. What led you to that position and then away from it?
Well, it's hard to even say what a full-throttle locavore is, but I guess what led me to it was, I think, like a lot of socially conscious consumers, I read the canon. I read Fast Food Nation, and I read The Omnivore's Dilemma and all of Michael Pollan's work, and found myself, you know, understandably, I think, quite attracted to the ideas of the local food movement. And in many ways, I still remain quite dedicated to those ideals. I did find myself questioning some of the applicability of these ideas, though. I mean, they worked for me in some cases, in some contexts, and I noticed that they worked for others in some limited ways. You know, it was convenient to go for a lot of people to go to the farmer's market and buy some produce locally and then kind of go home and say, well, I'm a locavore and I'm doing my part for the environment. And I guess I'm the sort of person that, you know, as a historian, when I see an idea become too popular, I also become skeptical. And my skepticism led me to really kind of put the movement under a microscope. And you know, like any reform movement you put under the microscope, you're going to find flaws. And my concern was that the popularity, the overwhelming popularity of this trend of you know, buying food local would prevent consumers, responsible consumers, from considering other important ways to think about sustainable food production for a global environment, not just for a local environment. So I think what ultimately tipped the balance for me was I started to ask the questions about sustainability and sustainable agriculture for the world rather than just for the community.
Mm-hmm. When is buying local the smart thing to do?
Well, it makes sense when what is being grown in a low-impact way. And for me, one of the first things I look at is water. And, you know, if a region has an ample water supply and you know, it's providing seasonal produce, by all means, you should buy that seasonally produced food. You should buy that locally when you can do that. But the fact of the matter is that's not every place. In fact, most places in the United States don't have the kind of water supply to support the production of a diversity of fruits and vegetables, or at least the diversity that I think most consumers have gotten used to. And this is a really important issue here, is we as modern consumers have become so spoiled. We've become so used to eating all kinds of fruit and vegetables and all kinds of foods all year round that you know, suddenly shifting our diet to just eat what is in season is quite noble. But I don't foresee that becoming a mainstream trend, and therefore I'm willing to entertain some other ways of thinking about food, and that is certainly food that can move from one part of the country or one part of the world to the other efficiently to keep us eating a diverse diet.
Yeah. There are many surprises early in the book here when you're talking about life cycle assessment. We can get into that in a moment, but it was surprising to learn that there are foods being shipped long distances that are greener than the local option. And there are three examples that I'm thinking of that you talk about early in the book: lamb, tomatoes, and apples.
Right. And, you know, what this point highlights is that when we think about the environmental impact of our food, we make a mistake if we just isolate the distance that our food traveled. And the reason why is, you know, life cycle assessments, these assessments of how food is produced from beginning to end, reveal quite convincingly and repeatedly that the, you know, the area where energy is really consumed, where fossil fuels are really burned, where greenhouse gases are really generated, is in the production phase. And so what that means is that if food is produced locally, but it's produced in an inefficient way, it really is harmful environmentally to buy that food. And there was a great study of a lamb that was produced in New Zealand, and if you lived in London and bought that New Zealand lamb, because the New Zealand lamb was pasture-fed, and it was quite low impact in terms of the chemicals that went into producing that lamb, you know, it was much more efficient to buy the lamb from New Zealand if you lived in London than to buy it from the countryside of England, where most of the lamb is produced industrially through confined animal, you know, feed operations and with intensive chemical processes that are, you know, consuming a lot of fossil fuels. The other example that you mentioned with the tomatoes. If we're buying tomatoes that are grown locally but are grown in hothouses, that's enormously more inefficient than importing tomatoes from the other side of the world that were grown under natural conditions. And these examples are becoming, I think, more and more they're becoming more and more available to people. We're hearing more and more about it. There was an article last week talking about how Sweden is undertaking an initiative to reduce its greenhouse gas emissions, and what they're targeting is food consumption. But instead of highlighting the distance that food travels, what they're doing is highlighting the overall carbon output that was that took place in order to produce that food. And, of course, what they're finding is no necessary correlation between local food having a lower carbon footprint. It's the factor is actually more, you know, what the food is. If you're buying lots and lots of fruits and vegetables and minimizing the amount of meat that you're buying, well, your diet's going to have a much lower impact than if it's you know, heavily meat-based. I mean, if you're supporting local agriculture but you're eating a heavily meat-based diet, not necessarily, at least in terms of energy and at least in terms of environmental consequences, that's not necessarily a good thing. So, you know, I'm aware that all of this can be very confusing, but I think, you know, one point that I hope, you know, listeners will at least entertain is that, you know, local works sometimes, and sometimes it doesn't. So we have to be careful about being fundamentalist about it.
The Swedes apparently are going to have labels listing carbon dioxide emissions associated with food production.
Yeah, which is in stark contrast to what many grocers in, well, at least I know England, are doing, which is putting stickers on the food indicating, you know, where the food came from or how many miles the food traveled. I know, and I've seen this informally here in the United States, going into certain markets and with signs showing, you know, how far the food came. And in a way, I mean, that's a bit of information, but again, you know, as I hope I'm making clear, it's one piece of information, but it's really just a small piece of the puzzle. I mean, studies have shown that transportation is about 10% of the overall energy required in the production of food from, you know, again, beginning to end in a life cycle assessment. So we have to be ready as consumers to take on some more complexity, perhaps, as we approach our food.
It was surprising. Home preparation sucks up a whopping 25% of the overall energy used, you report. And not too long ago, I had a guest on the program who talked about we might want to think about our ovens in the kitchen as Hummers.
Yeah.
They're really the oven and the refrigerator are two huge consumers of energy.
Yeah, it is. And you know, that example, I like that example a lot because it shows you what we're missing sometimes when we get overly focused on a single approach to achieving a sustainable diet. And, you know, again, this goes back to my point of, you know, my concern with the locavore movement certainly wasn't the core ideals of the locavore movement, which I very much support. But my concern is really with how this was blinding us to other ways that we might become more ethical consumers of food, and so you open up other possibilities, and suddenly things that are hidden in plain sight are right in front of you. And the amount of food that we waste in our kitchens is astronomical. It's like 17% of the food that we buy and ends up getting thrown out. And, you know, I have two children. They're 5 and 7. I'm constantly frustrated by the amount of food that's not being consumed or not being properly recycled. And there are decisions that we can make, you know, after the food crosses the threshold of our kitchen that can lead us to become much more responsible consumers. And as you point out, it certainly includes paying attention to the kind of appliances that we're using and how much composting we're doing. And I know in my household, once a week, we'll have a kind of clean-out-the-fridge meal, and it's sort of everything that's been left over from the meals we've been cooking all week. We kind of do something creative with it, and sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, but there's a certain sense of virtue that comes with it. I mean, a final point on this matter is, you know, and I say this having lots of friends in the restaurant business, but you know, eating at home in and of itself is far more environmentally efficient than eating out. As much as restaurants talk about their sustainability and their efforts to be eco-correct in their production methods, I mean, just as you know, as an operation, a restaurant is just more wasteful than an individual kitchen. And so that's also something to keep in mind as we kind of think about how we as individuals can make a contribution towards a more sustainable food supply.
Let's take a call. We've got a listener waiting to talk with us on line 4. Our guest this afternoon, James McWilliams, here on the Afternoon Magazine. He's the author most recently of Just Food, Where Locavores Get It Wrong, and How We Can Truly Eat Responsibly. Listener on line 4 on a cell phone. Good afternoon.
Hey, how's it going? Love your book. I have a friend of mine that has one of those, and I was reading part of it. But, hey, I wanted to ask you, with all your research, do you find that local farmers are better off than the big growers as far as, I mean, they're putting chemicals in everything anymore, and everybody seems to be getting this on the internet, on the news media every once in a while comes out. The big scare, like, for instance, across the border in Mexico. Shouldn't we have to be really concerned about where we get our food and what they're putting in it?
Right. Undoubtedly, a great benefit of buying locally produced food is that, you know, theoretically we have much better knowledge of how that food is being produced. I have a number of thoughts about this. I mean, on the one hand, to be a kind of devil's advocate of this idea, I buy a lot of my food from local farmers, and to be perfectly honest with you, and this is perhaps my own fault, I've never taken the step of actually engaging those farmers about their production methods. I imagine it would be much easier to do because you're buying food directly from the farmer. But I guess I'm not fully convinced that what I'm buying locally is necessarily, I mean, a lot of what I buy locally is not organic. So I don't know what kind of chemicals that they're using. And the other thing that I would say is, in terms of chemicals that are used on farms throughout the world, this is certainly cause for concern. And the way I approach it, and I'm the first to admit that this is not ideal, but the way I approach it is I buy no meat. I'm a vegetarian. And that, in and of itself, I believe, protects me from a vast international use and abuse of chemicals, because the vast majority of pesticides and harmful chemicals used in this country to produce our food are centered on the meat industry. Now, this is not to say, of course, that pesticides are not being sprayed on food and shipped, and I'm buying that food. But I wash my vegetables, I wash my fruit, I do all the things that the environmental working group tells me to do. I've got the top 10 worst foods for holding pesticides on my refrigerator at home. And so I guess I feel, and I've interviewed enough nutritionists who say, look, the nutrition, the vitamins and minerals that you're getting out of a plant-based diet really, I don't want to say counteracts, but minimizes any dangers to pesticide exposure. I don't want to minimize dangers to pesticide exposures at all, because it's a real issue. I've written a whole book on the history of insecticides. But at the same time, I feel like if I'm buying plants as the vast majority of my food, and I'm washing them carefully, and that to me is reassuring enough to feel like I'm eating as safely as I possibly can. Because the bottom line is this, and this is another important connection that really I don't make in my book, but it kind of came to me afterwards, as we minimize our meat intake, and a lot of consumers are doing this. You need more foods. You need a wider range of fruits and vegetables. And because that wide range of fruits and vegetables cannot be produced locally, I can't get local quinoa, which is a whole grain that I've started to eat a lot more of since I've become a vegetarian, or bulgur wheat, or papaya. Because we have to have a much wider range of food because we've eliminated meat from our diet, you know, we're going to have to eat globally. And so I think it's a reminder that there are trade-offs, but at the same time, we can minimize the risk. So not a perfect situation, but certainly better than it might be otherwise.
I want to thank the listener for his call. I've got some other folks waiting to talk with our guest this afternoon, James McWilliams, author of Just Food. The previous book that he mentioned about pests, American pests, The Losing War on Insects from Colonial Times to DDT. My name is Celeste Quinn. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Let's take another call. Another cell phone caller, line one. Hi.
Hello?
Line one, go ahead.
Yes, this isn't a cell phone, by the
way.
Oh,
okay.
That sort of threw me.
Okay. Urbana, I'm sorry.
Yes. I have a caveat with your guest statement that most of the, I think he was limiting to the United States, has insufficient water supply for agriculture, and I should have to point out to him that most of the United States is in California, where most of our vegetables are being grown with vast amounts of water, which isn't very economical, except that this government subsidizes, the rest of us subsidize their water supply. We can grow a lot of our vegetables here in the Midwest. Obviously, we can't do it as efficiently during the winter as we can during the summer, but we could certainly produce a great deal more. The efficiency in the industrial farms comes largely from the use of cheap labor. Back in the 70s, the Clinton's ag secretary, the ex-governor of Minnesota, had his people do some research and found that small farms are just as efficient. That is, medium-sized farms, at that time they considered a Midwestern farm of 250 acres to be as efficient as the very large farms. Reagan had that yearbook destroyed as soon as he took office. I think you will find that in this area, the market farmers are very efficient, making a decent living on smaller farms, and very competitive. Your example of lamb in London is at least not altogether accurate. Lamb can be grown in England without industrial techniques. It was for centuries. It probably couldn't fulfill the entire market for the English. It would probably be, on the surface, more expensive than bringing it from Australia or New Zealand. But it could be done. But that doesn't apply to the United States, where we could grow a lot more lamb and do it without industrial methods. As an old purebred sheep breeder back in the 50s and 60s, I know what can be done. And the way we do it today is decidedly not the right way to do it.
Okay.
Same with beef.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, well, let me
sort through those.
Yeah, address issues. Your first point, which I completely agree with. I mean, actually, in my book, I try to sketch out an ideal situation for the United States, and it would be mid-sized Midwestern farms producing a wide range of fruits and vegetables for people to eat. Which is, of course, the exact opposite of what's happening right now. As you pointed out, California produces our food. 50% of the fruits and vegetables consumed in the United States come from California. California gets its water from elsewhere. And one of the reasons why the Midwest is not producing our fruits and vegetables, which if we were going to pay attention to comparative advantage, going to grow food where it should be grown, and then ship it to places where it shouldn't be grown, like California, the reason why that's not happening is because of the Californians. The fruit and lobbies out there have enormous pull on how the food bill is written, and you're penalized in the Midwest for growing and marketing vegetables over a certain supply. So I simply couldn't agree more with that assessment. Now, as far as the meat question goes and what could be done and couldn't be done, well, sure. I mean, we can go back and forth with that until we're blue in the face, but the reality is it's not being done. For whatever reason in England right now, the vast majority of lamb, of course, is produced industrially. And my only point in writing about that case in my book was to, again, reiterate this point that we have to look at how food is produced before we make a decision about whether or not it's the best choice. And it was just an example that kind of conspicuously reiterated the argument that just looking at food miles is not going to be the single most effective way to gauge the eco-efficiency of our food. So, I want to reiterate that because then the caller then brought the situation back to the United States. sure, we could produce lamb the, quote, right way in the United States more often than we do. We could produce beef the right way or pork the right way, but we're still talking about inescapable inefficiencies compared to plant production, compared to growing fruits and vegetables and grains and legumes. I mean, you know, it takes 2,500 gallons of water to produce a single pound of beef. And, of course, that water is subsidized. If water was not subsidized, if irrigation systems were not subsidized, then our ground beef would cost $35 a pound. Frankly, I think that would be fantastic. Now, the other point here is that a tomato requires 13 gallons of water. And these kind of comparisons, I think, you know, we hear these numbers a lot. I mean, for those who sort of follow this argument about growing plants versus growing meat, we hear these arguments all the time. But I think we have to take them to heart. I mean, consumers are so frustrated with the industrial food system, rightly so. But what they can do immediately, right now, to kick it right in the stomach is to avoid meat, because 99% of the meat produced in this country is produced on a factory farm that is just dreadfully inefficient. And if you look at the, you know, agribusiness or the industrial food system, whatever you want to call it, if you look at it in its wholeness, meat is at the center. If you pull meat out of that system, it is going to be substantially weakened. And those smaller, mid-sized farms growing real food rather than, you know, crops that are fed to animals or ethanol plants or processed food, but farmers growing real food would suddenly have a real chance of redefining our food system. So, I mean, I have to confess to experiencing a certain amount of frustration, because in criticizing the locavores, as I do in my book, you know, many people have reacted by suggesting that I'm somehow in, like, a lackey or in bed with corporations and big agriculture, which is you know, simply not the case. And in fact, my argument that consumers should radically reduce, if not forego, meat altogether is about the most threatening thing you could suggest to agribusiness. So I just want to take an opportunity. It doesn't directly relate to the caller's question, but I just wanted to take that opportunity to make that point about meat.
Let's take another call, a listener on a cell phone on line 2. Hi.
Well, hello, Jane, and good afternoon.
Hi.
I'm on Interstate 70 heading back to my farm. I guess I'd be one of those local growers that you'd avoid, because my tractor fleet is nothing but a bunch of gas guzzlers from the 1940s, but I enjoy it, and I'm not going to change, period. But I guess what I was going to ask you is, if you did a cost analysis between basically trying to get rid of our 2,000-3,000 acre cucumber farms versus what I do, and how it affects the poor people and lower middle class that have trouble paying their bills, and what they would react to is if, one, not only something like that was implemented, but also the looming cap and trade would essentially jack up gas, diesel prices, and then make it even more expensive to make food, farm, transport food, and then make transportation even more difficult for folks. So I'm kind of asking a question like that on a practical money-in-your-wallet type scenario.
Okay, just so I make sure I fully understand the question. So, you know, you're asking if farmers transition from corn and soy to cucumbers or peppers or, you know.
We have some very large. I'm just over on the other side of the state next to St. Louis, but we do have some very large vegetable farms that I'm sure may be called industrial and probably poo-pooed by the local boars, or even if they did live right next to them, they probably would need it. They use even bigger tractors than I do. So, but yeah, kind of being a devil's advocate. But
it's a great point. I hope this response doesn't sound like I'm just pulling out the Trump card. But when I look at farms that are growing what I consider to be the right kinds of crops. You know, quite simply, food for people to eat, healthy vegetable plant matter for people to eat. When I look at that, the question that I ask myself is, if they're not profitable, why? If they're not eco-efficient, why? And on the one hand, I'm a firm believer in market principles driving what should be produced and what shouldn't be produced. But on the other hand, I'm also a big supporter of government incentives that lead farmers to be both profitable, that help farmers, hardworking farmers, be both profitable and environmentally friendly at the same time. I happen to think that that's possible, and I think one major problem with the locavore movement, and I haven't done a careful cost and benefit analysis of this, but you know, I feel from a macroeconomic perspective, I feel fairly safe in saying that farms can be big, farms can be industrial, and that doesn't necessarily mean they can't be environmentally efficient. We have to have the right incentives in place. I mean, back to my example earlier, why are so many farmers growing corn and soy and producing meat? Because there are incentives to do so. But the incentives come from the fact that farmers are not having to pay for the pollution that they create. And they come from the fact that farmers aren't having to pay for the water that they use. And the incentives are perverse incentives. I think they're perverse subsidies that are leading to ways of producing food industrially that are simply not sustainable, and we're going to have to change somehow in the long term. But on the other hand, if we had industrial systems that were growing the right things in the right way and there were incentives to help farmers do that, one example might be subsidies to support, you know, slow drip irrigation systems so that we used water much more efficiently. Or another incentive might be to help farmers purchase really high-grade fertilizers that have, you know, slow-release nitrogen rather than cheap nitrogen fertilizers that lead to heavy amounts of leaching. Something that I really learned as I did this research for this book, that, you know, all fertilizers are not created equal. Some are just a lot more expensive than others. So I guess the quick answer to your question is, I think that, you know, we can have clean, environmentally friendly farms producing that are big, that are industrialized, and that are producing a wide range of foods for people to eat, but the government's going to have to be involved in a very different way than the government is involved right now.
Does the listener want to follow up?
Well, I guess in a way I do see it, but I don't really see any practicality of, I guess, what I'm seeing with the environmental movements and those that believe in global warming is that they're constantly attacking fossil fuels, which is definitely the most efficient way to farm with. It's not using solar or wind or horses or child labor.
Right.
I'm kind of guilty of sometimes. But that right there is the biggest. My biggest fear is that, like I said, with this cap and trade, because that's probably what you'd be a proponent of, trying to get away from fossil fuels. But if that happens, that's going to dramatically shoot up my cost as a farmer, and then I got to push it off on the customer, whether it's somebody coming up to pick tomatoes out of the north field, or if I'm shipping it down to the grocery store. So, yes and no, but I might have to look up your book and see if you've got any numbers inside there and see what happens. But anyways, thank you for taking my call.
No, I appreciate the point, and the caller is off the air, but one thing I will add is that, you know, his question raises really one of, it's a pragmatic question, and a lot of times when I talk about this material to large groups, I say, well, we just, you know, people will say, well, how come we just don't have more organic agriculture? I mean, only 2% of the food produced in this country is organic, and there are great benefits to organic agriculture. Namely, its use of fossil fuels to produce food is much lower, and because they're not using these synthetic chemicals. So we have a situation here where you have conventional farming that's reliant on synthetic chemicals that require fossil fuel inputs, and then you have these farms that, you know, require minimal fossil fuels because they're not using synthetic chemicals. And synthetic chemicals are just one source of fossil fuels, but an important source. So the question that I ask is not are we ever going to get that 98% of conventional farmers in this country to go organic? I mean, I'm not going to ask that question because the answer is absolutely not. It's not going to happen. Farmers don't want to part with their chemicals. Most farmers I've talked to certainly don't. And I think in an age of climate change where we are going to confront environmental conditions that may change rapidly, that may lead to unexpected outbreak of pests or bacteria or fungus, I can certainly understand why farmers wouldn't want to part with these very powerful weapons. But at the same time, I think that there's tremendous room for improvement within the realm of how these chemicals are used. And I hinted at one earlier with, you know, the use of much more efficient fertilizers. I mean, there's a lot of research going into how we can make fertilizers more efficient. How can we use water more, you know, more judiciously? There's a lot of room for improvement there. So in a sense, sort of taking what we're doing and increasing the efficiency of it can lead to lower fossil fuel input that would lead to lower taxes if there were a cap-and-trade system in place. It may not happen immediately in the course of the caller's lifetime, but, you know, I think we have to think over the next couple of generations here, especially with the global population growing and this need to produce, you know, more food with fewer resources. It's really quite a troubling conundrum. But, you know, one thing that really pleases me about the farm that the caller just that he runs is that it's, you know, it is growing vegetables in the Midwest. And I didn't ask him about livestock, but I would point out that if we were producing more and more vegetables rather than more and more meat, you know, many of these issues would become non-issues. The amount of fossil fuel that goes into our food supply would drop dramatically. So,
let's take some more calls. Next, we go to a listener in Urbana on line one. Hi.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I would like to thank you very much for pointing out the inefficiencies of eating meat and the meat industry. I've been a vegetarian since about 1990. After reading John Robbins' Diet of New America, amazing book, especially since it's getting to be so old. My question to you is that, thanks for addressing the previous caller's issue. He may not believe in global warming, but I'm sure his children will. I'm sort of flabbergasted that so many people are not paying more attention to that. You know, it seems like sort of like the 98% of people ought to be understanding that's a reality as opposed to the 2%, you know, the 98 and the 2% you were talking about. What do you think Wendell Berry would have to say about his previous caller's idea about fossil fuel use? I mean, he still farms with horses. He's actually gone back to horses, and I've read a good deal of his writing about how he feels that the farmer's way of life would be a lot more pleasant and meaningful if they did go back to something like that.
Sure.
He also, you know, he'd comment on, I think he would sort of say that a lot of these large farmers are not farmers. They're really business people because they're just shuffling numbers of subsidies and insurance payoffs in the end. I mean, they're not really, they're sort of removed from the farming operation. I don't know if that's exactly a concise question.
Yeah, no, I can say a few things about it. I would point out that, you know, Wendell Berry is a pretty darn good businessman himself, but you're right in that he is undertaking a kind of pre-industrial agriculture that I have a tremendous amount of admiration for. I don't think Wendell Berry would have a tremendous amount of admiration for the way the previous caller grew his vegetables, but at the same time, Wendell Berry is not growing on that kind of scale either. I've read the works of Wendell Berry, and I've read Elliot Coleman, and you know, there are these farmers. There are these true farmers in this country who are just, I mean, they're brilliant at what they do. And the idealist in me looks at them and say, wow, what if everyone did it this way? Well, that's hard for me to imagine. I don't know that that's possible. I mean, so then the pragmatist, you know, the other voice says, well, that's just not going to happen. I mean, never, these are remarkable people, and the farms that they created are truly remarkable farms. And part of me thinks they're necessarily niche. You know, there's, we always need to have room for the Wendell Berrys and the Elliot Colemans of the world. I think that if we're so inclined and can afford to support that kind of operation, we should certainly do so. I know people who make treks to Kentucky to see Wendell Berry and to see his farm, and there's a kind of almost religious reverence for what he does. But like I said, the pragmatist in me knows that we can't replicate that. That can't be replicated by definition. We're going to have a scaled-up agricultural system that provides food for, well, in this country, hundreds of millions of people, globally billions of people. So I admire it, but I don't see it as a long-term 21st century replicable solution to the food problems that we face. And I also think there's a little bit of romanticism and nostalgia in what Berry is doing as well. I mean, if anyone comes close to living that nostalgia, it's Wendell Berry. I mean, he really kind of puts into practice what his ideals convey. But again, my own personal vision of agriculture is far less romantic, and I lean more in the direction of Victor Hansen Davis, who wrote a great book called Fields Without Dreams, about his experience as a raisin farmer in California back in the 80s, I think. And, farming is, on the one hand, working with nature. On the other hand, it's really manipulating nature to do our bidding. And there's something kind of harsh about it at its core that I don't know that Wendell Berry would agree with my assessment, but that's kind of how I feel about it. So a bit of a rambling answer to your question, but that's... those are my thoughts.
Okay, let's see if we can get another caller or two in here this afternoon before we're out of time. We go to another caller in Urbana, line 2. Hi.
Hello. Three things I want to know. Okay, the first one. I garden myself, okay, in my house. And the main thing I wanted to ask you, is there anything wrong with using fertilizer, and which one is the best? I'm talking about go out to the horse barn and get fertilizer, manure, and all like that. Is that good to put in a garden?
I think you should, yeah. If it's growing your food, absolutely. It's certainly healthier than the synthetic fertilizer that you might buy.
So which fertilizer is the best, the horse, the cow, the sheep, or the chicken?
It depends on your crop. And, it depends on what you're growing. Different crops respond better to different kinds of manure. You should call your extension agent, though.
Yeah.
I mean, there are people who will answer that question.
Okay, and also, which refrigerator and stove is best to buy?
Which stove?
The much better to use.
Well,
I'm gonna have to get me a new stove and refrigerator soon.
Yeah.
Which one is more efficient?
I don't have the information at my fingertips, but I think if you went to, like, say, Consumer Reports, and see if they have an answer to your question, I think if anyone had an answer to your question, I think they certainly would. But
okay.
I'm sorry, I wish I could give you a more specific answer, but then I'd also get in trouble for promoting a particular brand.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
Take care.
Bye. Happy gardening. Let's take another call. One last call. Line 3, Urbana. Hi.
Hi. Two comments. One, I'm a retired corn and soybean farmer, so I have experience with this and why it is that people do it. I think people underestimate the vast acreage we have here in the U.S. and that the idea that the corn and soybean acreage could be converted to vegetable direct to the table sort of crops is a fantasy. This year, we planted 150 million acres of corn and soybeans. I'm looking at the National Ag Statistics Service's California vegetable planted acres, and it looks to me like acres going from asparagus through broccoli to watermelon direct things in California is about 700,000 acres. That's about a half of 1% of the tillable acres in the U.S. So the idea that the only reason farmers raise corn and soybeans is because of subsidies, and take the subsidies away and they would grow tomatoes, we simply can't consume that many. And even on a global basis, we would be running out of our, you know, we would have vast, vast quantities of produce. And so that simply is not going to happen. And then the other thing, Wendell Berry's a great poet, a great writer. We need him to sort of hold a mirror up to us. But what he's doing is absolutely not sustainable. I ran a sort of energy analysis on my conventional farming operation, 500 acres, corn, soybeans, and wheat, with my Amish cousins who were using animal traction. About 30 to 40% of their planted acres was used to raise fuel for their horses. And my equivalent, if you looked at how many acres income I had to use to buy fuel for my tractors and combines, it was about between 1.5% and 2% of my planted acres was used for energy consumption on an annual basis for my crop production. So, you know, 19th century agriculture, organic agriculture, nearly spoiled the Midwest because of the vast erosion and so on. And so people have this romanticized notion. There's lots of things wrong with contemporary agriculture, lots of things we can do better. But to go Wendell Berry's route is the route to disaster, although
yeah.
I wish him well
yeah.
in his sort of, he's got a knife lifestyle, but go to your local, you know, he's supported by a university salary and income from books.
Oh, yeah.
I'm here at a farmer's market. Ask the farmer, do you have a pension plan? Do you have health insurance? Are you having a comfortable lifestyle that's commensurate with your community based upon the income from this, or do you have to have a spouse working off-farm to subsidize your ability to raise vegetables? I love the Urbana Farmers Market, but, you know, I know something about most of these people, and most of their customers would not be willing to live on the amount of income that can be generated from these sorts of things. God bless them for doing it.
Yeah, I mean, these are great points, and I really appreciate the perspective.
And I can give you about 30 seconds.
And I can do it in 30 seconds.
Okay.
We have this black and white view of things. I mean, it's either or. And I didn't mean to suggest that all the Midwest needs to convert to vegetables. I'm just suggesting that a great deal of it could. If we could maintain some of the corn and some of the soy and at least have some of that conversion over to vegetables, and there would be environmental gains to be made. And I'm well aware that doing this in a generation is difficult, but I'm trying to think 3, 4, 5 generations ahead. So
wow.
That's an all-too-quick response to a really good point.
Yeah, so complex. James McWilliams, thank you for joining us this afternoon.
I really enjoyed it. Thanks for the time.
You are welcome. James McWilliams is the author most recently of Just Food, Where Locavores Get It Wrong and How We Can Truly Eat Responsibly. The book is published by Little Brown.